I very rarely do episode in English because, well, Vlan is a French podcast, as you know. However, there are questions that I'm wondering all the time, like why are so many people experiencing mental health issues? What is happening with politics on the local but also on the international scene? How did we arrive in a situation where the world seems so binary when we all know it's super complex and nuanced? Is our society collapsing? How can we find meaning in life? How can we reduce our anxiety? And what should we do? In this episode, we are discussing all those very deep and important questions and many more with my guest, Jamie Will. Jamie is the founder of the Flow Genome Project and the author of Recapture the Rapture, which I simply loved. That's why I decided to do this episode in English because, well, I rarely read books that describe so well the situation we are in right now and explain the solutions that are accessible for all of us. To me, it's really a must read if you can read English. But from now on, and to convince you, I invite you to listen to our conversation with Jamie. Allez, Vlan, c'est parti. Hi, everyone. Hi, Jamie. How are you doing?
Great.
Great. How did you wake up this morning? Were you in a desire to save or to enjoy the world?
Goodness gracious. I think I just woke up this morning and I was just heading downstairs to a nicely fresh brewed pot of coffee and then I would see what would happen. So I might go out and savor the world on a paddleboard.
That's a good plan. I'm saying that because that's one of the sentences of your book, basically, that we have this desire sometimes to save the world and then also the desire to enjoy what the world is bringing us in the Occidental world. I would not argue that it's the same for everyone, obviously. That's why I was asking. I would love to understand what is your vision of the society today? And it's very interesting because in France, the situation is that the extremism is rising, both left and right.
Yeah.
And we feel like it's very specific to France, but it's not. It's actually the same pretty much everywhere. So I would like to understand, what is your vision of the society today?
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's what you just said is critical for anyone trying to sort of really have their fingers on the pulse of what's happening, because I'm blown away by how frequently people simply fixate on the sins of the opposition. So if you are a progressive, you become absolutely obsessed with what's happening in the alt-right. If you're a conservative, you become absolutely obsessed with what's happening with woke social justice. And really, they are both just symptoms of a bigger, more pervasive thing, which is arguably our meaning crisis. And the only reason that we have had this intensive polarization is that the consensus worldview, which used to include and contain both liberal and conservative positions, you know, it's the history of European thought, it is the post-World War II general kind of American peace, you know, and broad consensus. It was the move towards global transnational cooperation and participation. It was the support of fundamentally pro-social civil rights and humanist values, meaning that even if we don't quite always do this, a brown life halfway around the world is actually supposed to mean as much as a white life closer to home. And that even if we're not there yet, we're trying to get to a place of broad human equality. That entire sort of neoliberal, secular, humanist narrative has just collapsed. And it's collapsed not just because, it's sort of collapsed on both legs, right? There's sort of two pillars that held up our modern worldview. And the first one was organized religion, mm-hmm. you know, which, you know, if you think about it, for all of human civilization and predating civilization, right? It was our shamans and then our priests and bishops and rabbis and imams that told us what was a good life, what was our place in it, and how ought we act. And in the, you know, late 20th century to early 21st century, you had the sort of new atheists like Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, you know, and folks like that, Richard Dawkins, right? Like sort of actually gleefully marking the demise of organized religion, you know, and they were thinking that that, you know, religion was the opiate of the masses. Religion was infantilizing. It was filled with impossible superstitions and just-so stories and sort of good riddance to bad rubbish. And now we're all going to march into modernity together and we will be fundamentally effective altruists, you know, and secular rationalists. Mm-hmm. And that will be us growing up. But they really did skip what Nietzsche cautioned about, where he said, you know, because everybody remembers his bumper sticker, God is dead, mm-hmm. right? The idea of the collapse of the demystification of religion that came with the French Enlightenment, that came with rationalism, empiricism, the scientific method. Mm-hmm. But he said, hey, because this is in Thus Spake Zarathustra, right? This is, and the rest of his paragraph is the everything of that quote. He says, God is dead. And hey, friends and neighbors, be really, really careful when you murder your gods. Because when you kill your gods, you rip out of the social fabric all of your morality and all of your ethics. Don't for a second think that humans are actually as kind as we are when we're at our best and on our knees praying to a higher power. Mm-hmm. And so pillar one has been the collapse in organized religion. And in the last couple of decades, everybody's been tracking this, but the Pew Research Foundation in North America has been doing this. Western Europe's numbers are actually, I think, a little further ahead of the curve, right? You guys sort of went through your existentialism and despair after World War II and sort of grew, you know, shook off the cobwebs, where America has always had a more intense experiential religiosity to it. But even now, the nuns, none of the above. I don't affiliate mm-hmm. with an organized institution at all. I'm spiritual, but not religious. I'm agnostic. I'm atheist, whatever it might be, is now not only the fastest growing demographic segment, it's also the largest for the first time in human history ever. You know, you just think about that. 100,000 years of Homo sapiens, we always bowed to our gods. And if you didn't, you were a heretic, an apostate, a barbarian, a pagan. You were subhuman. Right? Mm-hmm. And cast out, right? So now that group, none of the above, is the largest rising ever. So we've killed Nietzsche's God. We've ripped out all of that, how ought I live? What is my place in the world and how ought I be? And that's one pillar that's gone down, you know, and with the burning of Notre Dame, right, the church scandals, rippling around the world, not just the Catholic Church, the Southern Baptist Convention, you name it, pretty much every organized religion, abuse scandals, all these kinds of things have really taken the shine off that rose. Mm. And at the same time, what we started this conversation with, the modern neoliberal globalist humanist project, right, has also been collapsing. Our faith in academic institutions, even if it's just things like those admission scandals in the United States that plagued all the Ivy Leagues and all the famous Hollywood folks and hedge fund managers that have been basically pay to play inside academia, the replication crises inside academia. Basically, if you've watched an inspiring TED Talk, pretty much anything you've ever seen that seemed neat and worth repeating at your next cocktail party has been now proven wrong. You know, whether it's Wonder Woman power poses or it's smiling faces with pencils or any of the neat Malcolm Gladwell-y shit just hasn't turned out to be the case. And then you throw in Goldman Sachs and McKinsey and what MDB scandals, you know, in Asia and McKinsey in South Africa and McKinsey also, you know,
in
helping.
France also.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
and help, you know, McKinsey actually helping strategize for Purdue Pharma after OxyContin was already definitively linked to the opioid crisis and then just helping them still market shit even better. And you're like, oh, you guys are craven. Right. So big finance, the place that, you know, every parent would have been delighted and proud that their young university kid got an internship. Like my kid's at McKinsey this summer, my kid's at Goldman, right? Now you're like, oh, you bastards. You know. So take that, take the church, take academia, take finance and the tippity top of professional business, and then throw in Silicon Valley, which was the sort of last utopian, we're all doing this to make the world a better place. Sergey and Larry go to Burning Man, so does Elon. We've got all cool bouncy things and colored bicycles, you know, in our offices, and don't be evil. you know, and now they're in cahoots with the Pentagon. Now they're engaging in censorship in China. Now they're realizing that, oh my gosh, our children's lives have been weaponized and they're all miserable and anxious. Oh, by the way, we're selling data to influence elections. So anyway, long story short, I think we all know after, you know, 5, 6, 10 years of doom scrolling, the stakes there. But what is really interesting, and I think pivotal to this moment, is that both sides, in, you know, if, as those two pillars have collapsed, organized religion, meaning 1.0, that was the old school version, and basically neoliberal modernity, meaning 2.0, as both of the, as the roof is caved in on that shared meaning, we're getting a vacuum. And, you know, I think it was Einstein that famously said, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, but so does culture, right? Culture abhors a vacuum as well. And that sucking sound we're experiencing isn't leaving people where Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris might have hoped, which was in a sort of evidence-based centered reality. We're getting sucked into fundamentalism on one side, and we're getting pulled into nihilism on the other. And so fundamentalism isn't just a doubling down on traditional religion, although that is also happening. It's fundamentalist QAnon. It's fundamentalist anti-vaxxers. It's fundamentalist, you know, George Soros and Klaus Schwab and the Great Reset. It's hermetically sealed belief systems that are not subject to inquiry, right? Or evidence-based challenge. Mm-hmm. That's fundamentalism. And then on the other side, for people who are like, yeah, no, I've just lost my belief in leaders. I've lost my belief in tops-down meaning-making of any stripe. Then quite a number of people and a huge number of young people are just succumbing to nihilism. Nothing matters. Burn it all down. And diseases of anxiety, despair, addiction, and suicide. So that's kind of where we are. So when we see all the churn and the chaos right now, I think it really is critical to pop up a level from polarization, and I'm in one camp, and then, you know, we're the good guys, and the other is the one, the other ones are the ones who have lost their minds. We've all lost our minds. And the key thing that we've lost is anything resembling a centralized narrative that we can all return to, even to fight the good fight amongst ourselves.
It's actually super interesting. I think, there's a few things that came up in the 20th century. This belief in individualism that is very connected to neoliberalism. So people really believed in the individual and really were fighting for themselves. That's somehow the American dreams also there. And this collapsed, especially we saw that with the vaccine. Like, it was very interesting to see that people believing in individualism, I mean, not all of them, obviously, but some of them were anti-vaccine. And at the same time, people were like, actually, we are a group of people, so you cannot like choose whatever you're going to do with your body when it comes to vaccine, because it has impact on other people. And that's, I think, it was a very clear demonstration that this individualism was collapsing. But what I think is interesting also is that there's a collapse in the belief in journalism, in politics, what you just described. And the question I'm wondering, do you feel like our society is just collapsing, or it is just faith that is collapsing? Is it the entire, because we have also a polycrisis, like ecological crisis, living crisis, geopolitical crisis, economical crisis, social crisis. I mean, there's so many crises. It's just insane.
Yeah. So the meaning crisis, right? The fact that we've lost organized religion, meaning 1.0, and we've lost kind of global secularism, meaning 2.0, isn't just happening in a vacuum. And in fact, many of the pressures that have created the cracks in that foundation and have caved the roof in are actually structural and physical. So your allusion to the poly crisis, right? I mean, the notion of, I mean, it's well established that something, one of the reasons we have such a challenge with dealing with quote unquote climate change is because climate change isn't a thing. It's a hyper object. Mm-hmm. You're never going to be driving down the street and go, oh, look, there it is. What you might see is a wildfire. What you might see is a flooded street. What you might see is hungry people. What you might see is tons of homeless folks. What you might see is a populist riot. You're never going to see a hyperobject. And that's very, very hard for our kind of evolutionary adaptations and even just sort of sense-making. How the hell do we see the world and what do we do about it to happen? But no, the meaning crisis is happening at precisely the same time, right? That many of the physical structures of the world are unraveling. And it's very easy for us to, and I think, you know, our friend and colleague, Tristan Harris, who's, you know, who was behind that very popular documentary, The Social Dilemma, and he heads up the Center for Humane Technology. He was a former ethicist at Google. So he's been kind of ringing the bell on this, of just the power of social media to kind of warp and capture our attention. But we were on a hike a few months ago, and we were talking about this, and he's like, look, here's the deal. You know, you can see that all the ad-incented algorithmic stuff on social media is designed to basically, it's limbic capitalism, right? It's the idea of like poke and prod us at a very primal level. Create awe and joy, like, oh, cute little puppies and pandas, but even better, create outrage, right? And then weaponize it. And what's happening is that we are right. Like our spidey senses that something is horribly, terribly wrong are absolutely accurate. Now, what's happening and who's to blame and what's to be done? That's that final 10%. And that is what is getting algorithmically warped and weaponized. And that is a massive, massive problem because it's our spidey senses is what we feel to be true. I am freaked out. I have a deep, deep feeling that the wool has been pulled over our eyes and we have been sold a bill of goods. Somebody is running off with the collection plate. Right. And right. And I don't fucking know who it is, but I'm empty pocketed and and everyone around me, you know, is missing our wristwatches. What's happened? And into that void, we're seeing demagogues. So if you think about, if you go back to 2016 and you actually watch the tape of Bernie Sanders in the US and Donald Trump, their critiques of what was wrong with America were 90% identical. They were like, hey, globalization came in and stripped the American heartland. We've eroded unions and workers. We've stolen the dignity. We're outsourcing everything for China for cheap shit in Walmart, right? We need to come back to rebuild our working class and our middle class, right? Check, 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 check. Now, what's to be done about it? They veered off completely from each other, right? And so, no, it's not just a meaning crisis. It is a meaning crisis as a, you know, I don't know what, third level up the stack of the poly crisis, where food, clothing, shelter, sustainability, viability are all also happening. And that is making it almost schizophrenic for people to make sense of and to come to sort of provisionally accurate, effective conclusions right now. It's kind of shit or go blind territory as to what's happening. And then also, you know, and I don't know to what extent this is true for your listeners, but there is this, the way I've sort of thought of this is that all of this, right, is happening at the same time that we have this incredible blossoming of personal growth. This was started in the 50s and 60s with the Beats and the hippies and the counterculture movement and the personal growth development, human development space. It's now getting lots of press and airplay with the psychedelic renaissance and with all of these things. There's all of these modalities for you to learn about yourself, get in touch with your feelings, heal your trauma, communicate effectively, experience peak states, blah, blah, blah. And at the same, and that's the kind of coming alive arc of life. We're like, hey, it's timeless, right? This is just me pursuing my hashtag best life, and the sky's the limit. And I want to go to Bali, and I want to go to Ibiza, and I want to go to Burning Man, and I want to, and, you know, and I've got my time with my therapist, and I've heard about ketamine therapy, and I want to do float tanks and saunas and cold plunges and all this wonderful biohacking self-optimization stuff. And hey, man, this is the best party ever, by the way. This is all the fun things. And that's timeless, right? And idealistic. But at the same time that we're all riding that curve, and it's not just for ourselves, right? It's also for society. We want to live in this beautifully inclusive, post-racial, fully humanist society where everybody has an access. And if there's a trigger warning or not a safe space, or if you're not using my pronouns correctly, I deserve to be seen and fully honored no matter what, no matter how much of a, you know, small percentage outgroup I might be, right? So we hold that not just for ourselves, but in progressive culture, people are holding that for everyone everywhere. And at the same time, we're running smack dab into the old timeless thing of staying alive. So there's coming alive up and to the right, but there's staying alive. And that is not timeless. That is time bound. That is the clock is ticking on all of our decisions. That is not infinite. That is constrained. And it's not about possibility. It's about triage. And we are at that intersection, which is how do I balance the infinite possible with the, you know, batten down the hatches.
It's very interesting that you mention all this work on ourself. I feel like it has been, I mean, all the not self-development, but self-care from the 60s, that was a movement against capitalism somehow. It was the society is pushing us because of performance optimization, and I'm kind of burnt out, so I need to take care of myself. And it changed into self-development somehow, which promises kind of become a better person, which is kind of a marketing option that it's a never-ending stuff. And actually, what I feel like, it's a bit weird for me somehow, and I did that. So I did a lot of things. My listeners would know ayahuasca, mushroom, you know, a lot of things. But what I think kind of weird is those people that are very much going to Bali and they are participating in the climate change also by flying everywhere. Well, first, it's not for everyone because of the money, but also, how do you feel about? There's a lot of criticism, telling it's about new age. It's a new kind of new age. There's new gurus and because people are lost and da da da. I would love to have your explanation or the way you look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, the thing is that, and I think the English filmmaker, the documentarian Adam Curtis, who does those kind of wild ass pastiche documentaries, I mean, almost to the point of self-parody, but they are interesting. He made the case that, you know, the big picture is, I would say, what we actually have right now is not some liberation theology as personal growth. What we have is a completely captured mixed spirituality that blends perfectly with the neoliberal consumer project. That's what we've got right now, which has helped me become more about me by buying things, consuming things, and doing things for me. So it's ultimately a capitalistic, narcissistic enterprise. But rewind the clock back to the 60s, and there was a huge amount of, you know, this was the early LSD blossoming. This was Ken Kesey and the Pranksters. This was the Harvard Project with Leary and Alpert, then Ram Dass and Houston Smith. And those early 60s era was an awakening of consciousness, often aided and abetted by countercultural and psychedelic modalities, with social awareness, with civil rights, with Vietnam War, anti-war protesting, with all of these things. And Curtis, Adam Curtis, makes the point that 1968, the summer of 68, was the pivot point. That was all of the student uprisings in Paris and Prague, right, throughout the United States, Chicago. It really felt like this was the moment, right? This was when it was all going to change. And the notion of revolutionary social justice was everywhere. And then that summer came and went, Bobby Kennedy gets shot, MLK gets shot, right? All of the things that happened. I think Fred Hampton is in there somewhere, right? Malcolm X, like boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. How long must they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? And Curtis makes the case that that marked the inward turn. And from there was a breaking of that social justice and civic responsibility ethos, and it all went within. And that's when we see the Back to the Land movement. We're no longer marching in the streets of the cities like we did in the summer of 68. We're now fucking off to the country and building communes, right? We're now no longer saying that the anger, the righteous anger of social injustice, is not the path change comes from within, right? It's not until I am healed, until I experience love, until I am whole, that the world can be. And you see that, and on the one hand, beautiful, right? And on the other hand, wildly susceptible to being infected with the, we'll just call it the neoliberal mind virus, right? Which is suddenly like, that's great. That's great. In fact, you know, there are arguments, and there's lots of messy, muddled history about this, that in fact, what could have been better as a CIA psyop or psychological operation, right, than to get people deeply down the rabbit hole mm-hmm. of LSD and potent psychedelics, because they became irrelevant. They absolutely crawled up their own navel gazing
yeah.
and simply became ineffective as agents of social agitation or change, right? And that's I don't mean that in some weirdly conspiratorial thing. There was direct and very, very strong links between Harvard and the CIA, between Leary and coordination and collaboration, between MKUltra and Stanford Research Institute and Kesey and the West Coast scene. So like, you're like, oh, that was perfect. Just give the kids the blinkiest, shiniest little toys to distract them, right, from the hegemonic project of American empire. And then you have late 70s into the 80s, the articulation of the New Age movement. You have the complete commodification of that, and all the way into Instagram shamans and lifestyle coaches. And it's a complete stitch up. So now you have the folks in Bali, you have the folks in Ibiza, you have the folks doing all the fun things, and they have completely abdicated, right, any social responsibility and any ethic of care. And if you track, you know, the most popular, you know, whatever you would say it, might, you know, movements in the New Age or sort of social technologies, an overwhelming number of them are almost neo-Vedantic in their DNA, meaning that this world is illusory. This isn't the real world. You know, this is why the Matrix is so popular. This is kind of a capitalist Gnosticism. Right, which is, this world isn't the real world. Change comes from within. And if I change my relationship, my mind, if I change my mental map of reality, then everything will change for me. And this is the secret. This is the power of manifestation. This is where we're going to vibrate to the fifth density. This is where starseed people, whatever wacky ass things folks are believing in. And that works incredibly well for the bourgeois worried well. If I have all of my material comforts counted for, probably in spades, if I have a house or several houses, if I have a nice functioning car, if I have a good education and a job I can work remotely during pandemics, if I have all my things, but I'm still just anxious, neurotic, and this somehow isn't enough, then I am amazingly susceptible to people saying, oh, just wiggle your hands and say some affirmations and look on the bright side and everything is groovy. And those social technologies work, or those psychosocial technologies work for exactly that, the bourgeois.
But it's,
they don't work for shit for people who are hungry and trying to provide for their children and are uncertain they're going to be disappeared or have a hard knock on the door in the middle of the night.
But it's how is it even possible that it's so contradictory? I mean, people that are into that bubble, they care. I mean, they care mentally, but they don't really care physically, because what they do harm people's life. I mean, most of people's life. So it's super contradictory. And yet when you talk with them, they are the most profound and interesting people. So it's always very weird to have those conversations, because they really do care when you talk to them. And they will be the one, you know, giving money for whatever situation. But at the same time, they're like, the actual lifestyle is harming so much people's life.
Like I will rage tweet as a liberal, right? The notion of some redneck in Texas driving his truck down the street, big jacked up truck with a Confederate flag, rolling coal, where they've hotwired their engine so that if they hit a button, it spills diesel onto the block and then it belches out big black clouds of smoke. And you're like, get a load of these horrible, awful people. But I think nothing of hopping on a jet to go to Coachella or Burning Man. Like, my carbon don't stink. But those bastards, get a load of them. Or, you know, the obvious of all the jets, you know, showing up for Davos, right? We're saving the world, so it doesn't matter if we slightly ruin it in the process. And, you know, for me, and this will seem, you know, hopelessly old-fashioned, but two of the test cases that come to mind for me is one from the Old Testament, one from the New Testament. The Old Testament one is Jonah, the story of Jonah and the whale, right, that everybody knows. But the backstory most people aren't as familiar with, which is that Jonah was a really successful businessman. And when Yahweh comes in and is like, hey, dude, I want you to go and save the people of Nineveh, which is actually Fallujah in Iraq, ironically. Mm-hmm. So I want you to go save the people of Nineveh. And Jonah's like, hey, man, I got a good thing going. I got business. I'm making bank. I'm not going to do it, right? And that's why he runs away. And so that question is fundamentally, do we hear the sacred calling or do we reject it to pursue material comforts? And then in the New Testament, there's the one with the Nazarene where Jesus is just about to start his ministry. So no one's following him. Nothing's happening. He goes to the Sea of Galilee. And there's like James and maybe Simon Peter. They all have double barrel confusing names, but I think it's James and Peter. And those guys have just bought brand new boats and brand new nets. And they are killing it, right? They are like, we're going to become like the fisher kings of the Sea of Galilee. And he's like, hey, right, put down your nets and come be fishers of men. And for me, both of those moments, and I ask myself this question, I've been asking myself this question increasingly over the last 10 years, right? At what point do we put down our nets, right? AKA the trappings of our material comforts and success. And what points do we just go and be fishers of men? What point do we show up for the least of our brothers and sisters? Because you mentioned, hey, when you talk to all these personal growth, new agey, global hip gypset crowd, right? They seem really sweet and dedicated and they are ish. You know, they are happy to put a black square up on Instagram during the George Floyd riots. They're happy to put a blue and yellow flag up for Ukraine back in March. They might not be noticing or paying attention anymore as things get really grim and ugly there, right? They are happy to virtue signal to others and for themselves that I am the right sort, right? But there is a place when we actually, at some point, right, just have to accept a walk-on part in the war. At some point, right, simply allowing those things to be happening and not take a stand in whatever way is, you know, appropriate, effective, but principled, for us to do those things. And I just think, you know, we are inching ever closer. It's the old, I forget the guy's name, the Protestant minister who made that famous saying about Nazi Germany. You know, they came for the gypsies, when they came for the Jews, when they came for the homosexuals, I didn't stand up. Da 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 da, and then no one was here to stand up for me. And we are experiencing that on a global scale of humanity right now.
So where can we find hope then? Because it feels like everything's collapsing. Even the people that have money, they don't really care. I mean, they care, but not really. They care-ish, kind of. It's not so much about, I don't believe really in the, you know, disappearance of human life, or I just feel that the condition of life on Earth will be harder and harder for more and more people. And eventually for people in Occident or, you know, the US and Europe, which are like very lucky not to experience so much hard condition, I mean, to my understanding, at least. There are a few, you know, things in the US, and there are a few things in Europe also, but compared to whatever happening in Africa or in Asia, it's nothing. Where can we find hope, and how can we do that?
Yeah. No, I mean, that is a beautiful question, and arguably it's the only question.
Yeah.
Right? It is. It's the only thing that matters. And you know, there's a saying in the Talmud, the Hebrew text, that is, you know, I think getting increasingly wide circulation. I heard it 20 years ago at a graduation speech, and it just gave me goosebumps. And I sort of never forgotten it. But it's this. He says, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief, Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You are not expected to finish the work, nor are you excused from it. And that to me, and this is actually, this just dovetails beautifully into the entire conversation we've had, right? About late stage capitalism, about individual, hyper-individual consumerism and mixed spirituality, right? Is, I mean, the first thing I think is we need to have rituals of radical hope. And I was at the Horizons Conference, which is the oldest and sort of most established psychedelic conference in the world. It was in New York City in December. And it took place over Hanukkah. And for reasons that others can explore, there is an asymmetrical representation of Jewish folks in the psychedelic community. So everyone from Rick Doblin at MAPS to Dr. Julie Holland to lots and lots of folks that have sort of gathered around that. And, you know, Rick Strassman has written some books on that. Is there any connection, you know, through long-standing Hebraic traditions of revelation and the psychedelic experience, et cetera? But anyway, the point being is that the conference took place over Hanukkah. And so many of the Jewish members of the community led a Seder dinner and also led Hanukkah observance. And it was the first ones I'd ever experienced or been exposed to. And I was really moved by it because I'm like, holy shit, you know, this is the Ashkenazi, like the diaspora experience. Like these are people who have endured centuries upon centuries of dislocation and suffering. And they have this ritual of the last time we were really, really up against it, aka the siege of the temple, something miraculous happened. And for eight crazy nights, right, the light kept burning. And that is a ritual, a transgenerational ritual of radical hope. And it's not just the Jews. You can think of the Roma. You can think of the Kurds. You can think of the Tibetans. You can think of the Uyghurs. You can think of you can think of every indigenous culture around the world, for that matter. And you think, okay, how have you done this? How have you created? This is almost like this Douglas fir are a big giant sort of, you know, member of the fir family, big old trees. And they have cones, pine cones, seed cones that only, they drum tight, rock solid, durable forever. And then it's after the fire actually cracks them open and germinates the seeds, right? So there's a chance for life specifically after the blaze. And I kind of feel like us both either reviving them is way better than building them from scratch. But if you don't have any lying around, build your own of transgenerational rituals of renewal and healing and forgiveness and hope. And that's really what we're trying right now. And Joanna Macy, who is she's 90 something now. She's a Zen ecologist, kind of grandmother of the sustainability movement. And she has a beautiful term for where are we in history right now? Because right, if we're talking about this meaning crisis, one of the first things to go is any overarching narrative of where have we come from? What's going on? And what do we do now?
And where we're
right? That's fundamentally what cultural stories do for us, right? They orient us in time and space and causation and purpose, right? And they're shredded right now, which is why there's so many cultic tendencies and so many fundamentalist movements rushing in to fill that vacuum. But if we basically say, she has a term for us, she's like, we are the people of the passage, right? And very straightforwardly, we are transitioning from the Pax Americana, just as there was the Pax Romana, right, for 1,000 years or so, right? We had 1945 until, take your pick, 2008, 2020, wherever. That was 75 years of absolutely unusual global peace built on the wreckage of World War II, built on Bretton Woods, built on the global, you know, U.S. dollar as reserve currency and U.S. Navy ensuring globalized shipping and coordination, and all you European countries were on the same side. Now you get to sell shit to each other, but you don't get to fight anymore, right? And even the terrorists, right? Everybody observed the one sacrosanct rule from the 1970s to now, which was nobody fucking attacks global shipping. Nobody did. You blew up other stuff, right? But no one took a swing at container ships, which gave us Amazon one click. And basically, you know, like in the era of the Silk Road, in the era of old school global trade, right? The cost of a good was about 90% transport. Every single middleman took their cut, doubled the price, took their cut, doubled the price. And by the time it got to you, it was incredibly expensive. Today, the cost of shipping is 2% of what we see on Amazon, 2% instead of 90%. And this has all happened, right, at the same time that we found 200 million years of buried starlight under the ground and figured out how to set it on fire. Right. So there's 8 billion people. Like when you and I were born, there were half as many people on this earth. Mm-hmm. Right. When era of Jesus, right, going back to zero BCE, there were about 20 million people on this earth. During the hunter-gatherer, 90,000 years of everything we've ever done, there were roughly 100,000 humans on the planet. And we've gone since 1970 from 4 billion to 8 billion, largely through the miracles of the American peace and nitrogen, basically fossil fuel derived nitrogen fertilizers, right? That shit's going away. We have sucked that 200 million years of starlight down to the dregs, and it's not filling back up. So we have this choice of how do we transition off this carbon pulse? And by the way, like, you know, just to put it in perspective, because people think often that there's a sort of moral negative to the fossil fuel economy. Like, how could we have done this? How could we have trashed our planet? What about all these microplastics? What about all these horrible things? How have we been so bad, so evil, so wrong? And then you're like, oh, one barrel of oil, which, you know, up until recently was roughly $100, probably 150 now, I haven't checked, but you have a choice. Do you spend $100 or do you engage in for a barrel? Or 4.5 years of hard manual labor. That's what a barrel of oil represents, right? And today we've got 8 billion people, way too many, not necessarily in some Malthusian sense, but just artificially boosted by this carbon economy underpinning it all. But we have access. We are leveraging, depending on who's doing the maths, 250 billion humans labor. 8 billion of us are enjoying the effective labor, basically juiced by fossil fuel production, of 250 billion people. So we're very acutely aware that slavery was a bad thing and we really shouldn't do that, right? But you realize, oh, we're engaging in temporal slavery right now. We have enslaved our descendants. We are basking in the insane abundance of the labor of 250 billion humans that haven't even been born yet. And we're burning their carbon legacy right now.
And yet people, it's very interesting. You know, actually, I wrote a book also called Unsustainable Paradise. And the subtitle is Ecology and Lifestyle. How can I change without sacrificing everything? Because actually, people are kind of aware, I guess. Now, at least in Europe, it's very clear that people are aware. And yet, they don't want to change anything. And there's this sentence in your book that I love, which is, and it's very weird because... You say things get exponentially worse and better at the same time. And that's where people also are lost. Like, because, and you made the case, I mean, if you look at numbers, number of deaths, number of, child deaths, people starving, it's getting better. It used to be better in the late, since the 70s or the 50s. And now, like, we're like, well, but that was not the right path. We were wrong there. So that's also that. I mean, how can you not sacrifice anything? Because people don't want to decrease. Nobody want to decrease really.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think the simplest thing, and Europe is definitely further along than the US. The US is the ridiculous outlier. We burn 12 kilowatts. I forget the unit, whether this is daily, annually. It must be a run rate.
Yeah.
But 12 kilowatts is US consumption. I think 8 to 10 is Western European. And then sustainable is 2 kilowatts and below.
Exactly.
Arguably all the way down to like 500. 500 watts. And there is an organization, Kim Stanley Robinson, the futurist, who was then invited to COP26, wrote that book, The Ministry for the Future.
I love that book.
Highlights, right? He highlights and signposts the 2 kilowatt society, and that was based out of Zurich, I think. And their whole premise was, hey, we don't need to be consuming as much as we are. What if we lower our consumption voluntarily to then model that actually quality of life, satisfaction, all the happy intangibles don't go down if we do this on purpose ahead of necessity. And there is 4 to 6, I think, cities in Europe that are now sort of signed on as 2 kilowatt society urban areas. And their numbers are proving that out. And so I think the simplest is to say, there's so many studies that underscore this, right? But the excess of material consumption very quickly flattens out. Now, the numbers, the classic number is like $75,000 a year in the US. That's been revised. Sometimes it's upwardly revised. Actually, no, more money does make you happier, $150,000, whatever. I mean, my personal sense, and this will wig out any middle class folks that think that this is a pipe dream, but I would think that really after, and I'm talking about like for ultra high net worth folks, right? Because there has been this incredible consolidation. I mean, the 1% of America now owns, well, in fact, 1% in the world owns more than the bottom half of humans. And in fact, I was writing Recapture the Rapture, and I had a sentence early in the beginning, and it said, when 39 people, right, who could all fit comfortably in a bus, not that they'd ever ride one, right, own as much as the bottom half of humanity, we're in a tight spot. But I went back to fact check it. And just in the 9 months of writing the book, that number had gone from 37 or 39 down to 23 people. Now they could fit in a stretch limo. So you could, I think, really credibly say that no human needs or even deserves more than $10 million.
No.
And after that, you should be playing with the house's money. This is Tolstoy's old thing. I think it was in War, maybe it was Anna Karenina, but he said, every great fortune begins with a theft. And that sounds hopelessly idealistic / Marxist, but I think literally you can say that any kind of excessive extraction and hoarding of that much life force, because literally money is just a unit of accounting for energy, right? Anybody, there's not a natural system. There's not a galaxy. There's not a pond with frogs and lily pads. There's not a forest. There's not a single system in nature, micro or macro, where that kind of asymmetric hoarding and extraction is remotely sustainable. So the 2 kilowatt society, to your point, right, is that we can absolutely, radically, and massively downgrade our excessive consumption and upgrade our life satisfaction, relational connectedness, health, and vitality. And I think, not to hang it all on these folks, transition towns is another movement that started in the UK and is also global of like, how do we start re-knitting, getting out of these atomized consumer individual senses where I don't even know my neighbors and we all commute and we spend all of our time staring at screens, right? How do we re-knit the fabric of community? And how do we also voluntarily in nations and regions of privilege, how do we voluntarily step down? Because to consume more than what all of us could have becomes at some point an ethical act, right? And also a model, right, to help sway political opinion, because most politicians are just hijacked by, I want mine now. And if you don't give me mine now, I'm going to vote you out of office and put someone else in who promises it, whether they can deliver it or not.
Then I have a question for you. Well, I have many questions, as you can see. What is success for you in the 21st century? Because success, I mean, in my understanding, it used to be accumulation of power, of money, of things, of fame. But that is burning a lot of energy, all this accumulation, obviously. So for you, what would be success today or in the society that you're describing in the book?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, all I can, I think the most honest answer is just what does it feel like for me, right?
Yeah, also.
And
but it can be a movement. I mean, you don't have to be there straight. We all have our contradictions, I guess.
For sure. I mean, mine and my wife's background was as mountain guides, you know, adventure athletes, academics, creatives. You know, she's an artist. I like to write, tell stories, think things. And fundamentally, I mean, to me, the life that we've always been shooting for, it hasn't changed a bit. It's just the price tag has gone up. You know, like when we were in school together, it's like all we wanted to do was buy a dirt cheap mining claim in the mountains of Colorado and put up a yurt with a wood stove and a solar panel and ski and mountain bike and be in gorgeous nature and be self-sufficient, because that was just, you know, something we practiced in the backcountry and valued, live with as light a footprint as possible for as high a quality of life as we could create, close to nature and the wilds, self-sufficient, with family that we love and are connected to, and community that we mark the seasons with, right, and get to celebrate and grieve together. And that's very much in the kind of, you know, the Talking Heads, you know, lyric of like, same as it ever was, same as it ever was. You know, these are fundamentally human needs. These are nutrients. And it's that healing, inspiration, and connection, right? We need inspiration periodically, and that can be ritualized, that can be incidental, right? It could be a sunrise hike. Oh my gosh, didn't expect to see that incredible sunrise or mountain lion. I'm moved. It can be ritualized, like Hanukkah or like a summer at Burning Man. It can be periodic renewal where we, you know, in those states of inspiration, there is often, not always, but often, an experience of what the Greeks called anamnesis, which is just the opposite of amnesia. So instead of forgetting, you're remembering. So anamnesis is the remembering of what you've forgotten, right? So some deep, oh yes, I remember my point. I remember my purpose. I remember the thread, this thread of quicksilver that connects me to the mystery. And quite often, those peak experiences also remind us where we're broken, give us insight into where we're wounded or contracted or where we've taken hits from the last time, you know, that we were here at the kind of altar of life. And then healing, right? We need to heal. Otherwise, we're just an accumulation of our traumatized baggage. And then we become less resourceful, more reactive, and generally perpetuate more, you know, more of the same. And then lastly, connection. We are social tribal primates, and love and care for family, for community, and potentially, and this is a huge potentially for all of humanity. But we don't get to play that game unless we are vitalized, engaged, and supported at the levels of personal, familial, and communal. Because I think this is really something that a lot of well-intentioned, let's just say progressive folks who are still hold the value of humanism, everyone everywhere, entitled to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, regardless of race, color, or creed, right? That stuff rolls off our tongues like a cliche, but it was actually a profoundly novel human invention. There wasn't a single tribe or clan of people anywhere in the world that was ever like, yeah, people who don't worship our God, people who have different skin color, who wear different things, who live across the river or over the hills, they are actually entitled to everything we are. That was a relatively novel evolution. And the key for people to understand is that, you know, tribalism is destiny. That is what we are biologically, evolutionarily, even neurochemically incented to care about, is the propagation of our genes and those of the people like us. Yeah. But human, so tribalism is destiny, but humanism is optional and elective and fragile. And so if we want to hold that up as this noble ideal that we have a chance to champion, that to me is arguably, that's the beacon, right, that we can come back to again and again to source from radical hope. So just to kind of, you know, kind of tie up some of the things you're asking, you're like, well, hey, how do we live right now? And I would say the simplest is 2 kilowatts, like Google 2 kilowatt society, learn what they're doing, see how it fits for you. And both as an ethical act, like I am deliberately virtue signaling, I'm saying this is something I believe in and I'm doing it, and I want other people to see it and take note of it and maybe even and be invited into joining. But then also just basic self-sufficiency. Can I live more lightly and more self-reliantly on this earth? Because, oh, by the way, all those dirt cheap, just-in-time global supply chains are going away and never coming back in our lifetimes. I think that is a fair, I don't think that is an alarmist statement. I think that's just a reading of straightforward cycles of history. So do that. And then how do we make this transition from the rational consumer egoic identity, which is we have all been conditioned to say, I want mine and I expect to get it in my lifetime right away. And if I don't, I'm going to pull a Karen and I'm going to complain to the management. Right? Yeah. And that's 100 years of consumer society. Tim Wu, who's a law professor at Columbia, he's advised a couple of White Houses. He was the originator of the term net neutrality way back in the early 2000s about how the internet should stay open and free. But he's also written a series of fascinating books. And one of them is called The Attention Merchants. And it's basically just describing the evolution of consumer marketing culture in the 20th century and how everything from Silicon Valley and Facebook and Google have come to capture us. But the history of it. And the crazy thing is that the founders, the three most central founders of modern marketing. So this is before Mad Men, before Madison Avenue in the 50s, right? Like the 20s, they were honest to God, like literal snake oil salesmen and failed evangelical preachers. And they took that redemption story, right? Of religiosity and you can have the thing. I mean, the snake oil playbook, which was always with some super secret ingredient, is identical to all the biohackers. Like it hasn't changed, right? And you realize, oh, fuck, for 100 years, we were conditioned with this basically consumer version of Christian redemption to think, I have fallen from sin. I have chronic halitosis. I have dandruff. I have saggy diapers that leak. I don't have beach muscles. I don't have something that will deliver me money, sex, power, fame, adoration, deliverance. And if I only buy that, I'll get it. And then I'll be whole. And we have been, and it's about me now and mobility. People move 5 times. They don't live next to their parents. They don't grow old with their elders. I do Botox and I ship my fucking grandparents off to nursing homes to be managed by, I mean, this is maybe less true in Europe, but like to be looked after as they die, medicated up to the gills so they're docile and cared for by minimum wage and strangers. Like we do that. And instead, the re-knitting together of those social ties and social networks. And so the notion of like humanism is optional and fragile, right? But tribalism is destiny. I think we are very, and most well-intentioned, progressive people who've had expansive personal growth experiences, psychedelic experiences are like, oh, we're all one. I see that now. We're all just love. We're all just light. And what we really need to do to save this fix we're in, right, is for everyone to realize that, right? And the answer is, hey, we had 75 years, folks. We didn't pull it off. We didn't really even get close. In fact, this entire noble project got fully hijacked and captured by consumer capitalism. So this, to me, the analogy is closer to mountaineering. And when you slip on a big snowy mountain, the first thing you do is you self-arrest with your ice axe so that you don't get going so fast you can't stop and you just slide off the edge to your doom. Mm-hmm. So what is our self-arrest move right now? Our self-arrest move is not saying that everybody around the world needs to do psilocybin and heal their inner child. Not going to happen, right? And even if it did happen, lots of variations and interpretations and applications. But what we really need is a healthy return to bioregional tribalism. I live here in this place. This is our river. This is our farmland. This is where we live and grow, right? And this is our community. Now, tribalism, as we all know, right, is wildly problematic, right? Because tribalism is typically based on blood and soil, right? Ethnicity or creed. Whose God do you worship? And we know those don't work well. We know those really tee us up to be horrible to other people and justify all kinds of things. So what is a healthy postmodern tribalism look like? And I think the only healthy one I can think of is that bioregional one. We live here, we give here, right? We are neighbors. So let's figure out what we have in common right? So that we can re-knit together all of those meshworks, right? I mean, in some respects, it's almost as if, you know, humans, tribally, culturally, we used to live in forests. And as everybody knows, all the roots now connect, the mycelial networks transmit information, you know, immunity, information, resistance, even chlorophyll and photosynthesis, we share, right? We're all knit together in a forest. Well, instead, now, we're all potted plants. We're all trees in, living in buckets, and our root balls are tight and constrained. And if somebody doesn't give us artificial fertilizer and water from another place, we die, right? That's us right now. So how do we get out of those buckets that we've grown up in and then reconnect in the soil to each other and then interconnect, right, with our roots and our shoots, right, and our mycelial networks? And so to me, that's the simplest is, you know, grieve. Like, I don't know if you guys have this bumper sticker in Europe, but there was one that was very popular in the sort of Prius to Tesla Whole Foods kind of market sense, right? So you could just picture them in the parking lots. And the bumper sticker said, think globally, act locally.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Right? Right? Nice sentiment, right? But I think we kind of need to upgrade it to deal with the poly crisis. And it's instead of think globally, act locally, it's grieve globally, thrive locally. So grieve globally, like pay attention. There's some gnarly shit happening. And there's a lot of humanity that is under the gun, literal and figurative, right? So take in the wound of the world. Don't duck it, but nor get collapsed by it, right, into despair. Thrive locally. Like everybody's sort of frantic and bored right now, right? Quarantine kind of left everybody at the end of their ropes, but on the other hand, waiting for what's next. And we're just kind of getting agitated and irritated, and we're watching too much Netflix, and we're spending too much time on Twitter, and we're getting wrapped around the axle of a bunch of trivial shit and burning daylight. So thrive locally. Like if we're not digging in the soil, if we're not reconnecting with our ride or die community, like who do I love? Who do I care about? Who do I trust? How do we go from, you know, FaceTimes and Zooms to actually making life together, right? How do we take responsibility to become a little more resilient, a little more self-sufficient? Those to me are the key moves right now. And then there is something along the lines of dusting off and reviving or creating durable intergenerational rituals. Because if I think the hard truth of it is that, you know, and Peter Zeihan just wrote a book called The End of the World is Just the Beginning. He's a global strategist. And he echoed something that I had written. In fact, it took me 100 pages to make the case 2 years ago. And he just wrote it in one page in the introduction, first page of his book. He's like, hey, friends and neighbors, the last 75 years have been fucking fantastic, and they're never coming back. Life will never be richer, cheaper, faster, or more peaceful than it has been in our lifetimes until now. Right? So that means we're in for a whole lot of sadness, frustration, and disappointment. If, you know, and our little potted plant, our little rational, fragmented, consumer-conditioned zoo animal identities that are expecting everything now where we call the manager to complain, right? That's out the window. That will crush us. So how do we get back to that Talmud? Quote, we're not expected to finish the work, right? That's the enormity of the task. Right? Nor are we excused from it. We have to try anyway. And to me, that speaks to transgenerational or intergenerational consciousness, which is really how every immigrant family, every immigrant parent, right, who's ever struggled and saved. I was a PhD in Kabul, and I'm now washing dishes or collecting trash in Iran so that I can get my kids to Lebanon, so that my grandkid can make it to Berkeley, right? Or Oxford, yeah, right? Right? Like that movement has always been essential, which is seven generational consciousness, right? The Iroquois Confederacy were sort of famous for popularizing that, right? But it's seven generational consciousness is sort of a weird abstraction. But if you really want to ground it, you're like, oh, I am in the center of seven generations. There are three generations behind me. There's my parents, my grandparents and my great grandparents. We can still touch them in our family stories and hand me down wisdom. Can I honor and appreciate, right, how hard they had to struggle to bring me the light, right? And if they only got me a little coal, But now I've blown it back into a fire. And I'm basking in that blaze, right? I am whole. I'm having peak experiences. I have love and light and joy in my life. Can I begrudge them, right? For the little bit they gave me? No, of course not, right? All I've got is gratitude. Like, thank you, even if you were alcoholic, even if you were traumatized, even if you were emotionally repressed, even if you never, you know, loved me in the way my therapist told me I deserved to be loved, right? Fuck all the bit, you know, nickeling and diming. Thank you, ancestors. And I'm gonna do this for you guys. And then also the three generations ahead of me, my children, my grandchildren, and my great-grandchildren. So now I have buffered my basically satisfaction and endurance. I have increased my grit. I have increased my ability to suffer on behalf of something bigger than myself, right? And I have ennobled or valorized, right, going into the shit. Because now I'm not just doing it for me, and now I'm not just sucking my thumb if it doesn't all work out tomorrow. And you know, that's Moses and the Promised Land, like 40 fucking years in the desert. Poor bastard doesn't even get to the land of milk and honey, right? But he does get his people to the doorstep.
Totally.
And that has to be enough. And so that's what I mean about like rituals of intergenerational hope. Right? Reducing our footprint now, both for the positive example of the 2 kilowatt notion, but also for just common sense, sustainable, thriving locally. And then can we shake off the potted plant notions of our identities as separate, isolated, and highly dependent on outside sources of sustenance and reconnect ourselves as a forest of community that relies on each other and also supports each other?
That's very beautiful. And also you talk about breathing, sex, embodiment substances, and music. Mm-hmm. What are they for you? Like, are they part of this kind of... I'm really with you regarding the sacred and the lack of sacred and the need of sacred. But do you think those five things are basically part of the sacred, or... They are part of being anchored somewhere with your tribe?
Mm. Well, I mean, I think, so it was the five things that I describe in the middle section of the book, which is called The Alchemist's Cookbook, how to basically, you know, enact ecstatic, cathartic experiences, so peak experiences that also inspire and heal, with household materials. Right, because if you just take a look at the psychedelic renaissance, right, and a lot of people are like, oh, everybody needs to do bufo, that, you know, the wonderful desert toad, or everybody needs to do some exotic, you know, compound or chemical, you're like, okay, well, that's well and good, but that doesn't scale. And neither does, you know, transmagnetic stimulation or crazy high dollar headsets or any of these things. But what does scale are our own bodies and brains. And the closer you are to evolutionary drivers or impulses, the more punch they have. So we have to breathe or we die, very, very straightforward. And therefore, breathing has all sorts of capacities to shift our consciousness and our physiology. You can upregulate to become more alert and engaged before you do a hard engage. You can downregulate if you're stressed or anxious, and you can even transcend accelerated breath work, Wim Hof, holotropic breath work, all of those things, all because if we don't breathe, we die. So there latent in our system is this is a very long lever. This is Archimedes, right? Saying, give me a lever long enough and I can move the world. Well, evolutionary requirements are our long levers. Sexuality and the impulse to procreate is one of is the next most powerful, right? The moment, as long as we're breathing and we have food, the next thing we think about is sexuality and reproduction. Now, evolution is fundamentally amoral. It doesn't actually care what we care about. It only cares about a robust, genetically varied gene pool. So it plays all sorts of dirty tricks on us, from lust and attraction to infidelity to ovulation and conception. Like, we are just puppets on the string of an indifferent evolution. But those neurochemical primers and prompts and urges, I mean, think about it, right? For millions and millions and millions of years, and for sure the last 100,000, we have figured out, as has every vertebrate, how to have sex and procreate with no instruction manuals. This is long before Pornhub and long before the Kama Sutra. We figured out how to put our bits together and make more of us. So you have to think that is incredibly strong incentives. So if you can come back to that network in our system and move beyond the taboos and the moralizing and even the obsessive compulsive natures of unconscious sexuality, it's just there as a profound set of tools for effectively sexual fitness, right? How do you actually reclaim our sexuality to heal and mend trauma, to prompt connection between others, and taken to its logical conclusion, access transcendent and peak state. So that's just there lying around and everybody has it and it's free. And we're all doing it anyway. We're just doing it really badly. So bring that back online, right? And then music and substances, well, embodiment is another one, right? Just what is happening in our systems and how do we learn to regulate our neurophysiology? Basically, how do we train our bodies and brains to uphold and support our hearts and minds? That's it. And then the last two are really just force multipliers or amplifiers, which is music and substances. And every society has its preferred list of substances and its prohibited lists of substances. But the reality is that learning to use state-changing chemicals to inform us is not just a human tradition. It goes back, it's not even just a primate or mammalian, it's even in birds. Like Ron Siegel at UCLA has called it our fourth evolutionary drive, intoxication, or the capacity to shift cognitive state via exogenous or external consumption, right? With elephants, slurping down fermented barley or fermented berries. Like, we do this and we seek it out because it interrupts ruts of cognition and habit, and it prompts lateral connections and novelty in ourselves and in our cultures. And music, Ron Siegel, who was at McGill University, wrote a book called This Is Your Brain on Music. And he actually makes the case based on the archaeological record that music even predates language. So when you hear most anthropology 101, they're like, man was, a hairy ape, and then we learned to walk upright, and then we made fire, and we did tools, and we had language, and ta-da, right, here we are, right? But between Jared Diamond, who is also at UCLA, he wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel, mm-hmm. He won the Pulitzer for that. He has a book called Why Is Sex Fun? And he says, actually, you have to look at two things. One is you have to look that sexuality is our unusual sexuality, like how humans do it. Right, which is sex outside of ovulation, female orgasm, permanent breasts and hips on women, oversized penises compared to the rest of the apes for men. All of this is radically novel. And you can make a very strong case that our sexuality was a huge part of shifting, expanding, and developing our consciousness and self-awareness. He's like, he says, it's the third leg of the stool here. You can't just say it's opposable thumbs, right? And fire or tools. And Ron Siegel makes a complimentary case about music. He's like, the oldest bone flutes are 50,000 years old. That's earlier than any indications of language. And you know that straight up drums, hoop drums, percussion predate flutes. And so you can make a case that music was our original language, and it's profoundly neurochemically entraining. It shifts us, it gathers us, it bonds us, it helped us stay awake and tend the fires, it helped us coordinate for hunts. I mean, how did a bunch of dumb monkeys take down woolly mammoths and all the megafauna, right? We did it by coordinating activity, a bunch of puny, weak, slow primates, but together we were something formidable. And music is arguably one of the core cohering technologies we had. Mm-hmm. So if you take all of those together, you're like respiration and sexuality, very strong evolutionary drivers, and embodiment. I mean, these are our bodies. So how we attune our bodies and brains shapes our hearts and minds. And then you add the turbo buttons of music and substances, you could make a case. And there are for sure others, right? But those five are very, very core sort of Lego blocks for building healthy culture, right? That allow us inspiration, healing, and connection.
Right. Is there a question, Jamie, that nobody's asking you and you are dying for people to ask you?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. I mean, yes, right? I mean, I think, I don't know if this was true for you, but it's always true for me. Anytime I write something, I am just hoping that someone is going to read it. They're going to connect all the dots and they're going to ask me either the secret thing I was pointing at or find some anomaly or curiosity, right? And then be like, and I disagree with this and here's why. And then we're in a fun new conversation and I don't know where that ends up. I think for me, I mean, I think the thing that I stuck my neck out a bit to try and signpost in the last third of the book was effectively, okay, you know, we have this unprecedented access to peak states, right? And people are blasting off into all sorts of non-ordinary realms. But most of them are sort of just bungee jumping into the back of beyond. Mm. You know, they're spending 10 minutes to a few hours in these wild and magical places, and they're coming back to reality. And then they're just spewing stories about what they think it all means. And my sense is that there are enough psychonauts now coming and going from non-ordinary post-conventional realms that shouldn't we start mapping that terrain? Shouldn't we start sincerely inquiring if those states are consistently high information, like high bandwidth, high information, high inspiration? Where is all that information coming from? Right? Where are we going? Not just in my own individual landing zone, right? But what is the topography of that landscape, and what are the physics of the metaphysics? How does that space operate? And so for me, the sort of where does the information come from in not sustained non-ordinary states? I can't believe more people aren't asking that. And you see the absolute deficit in it in the psychedelic renaissance, right? Because it's all of that advocacy and work, which I, you know, love Rick, love MAPS, love and support all the good work they're doing. They kind of made a Faustian bargain where they're like, we promise not to talk about the mystery. And we're promised to like wear suits and ties to our congressional hearings and act like this is just like Prozac, but slightly better or a lot better. Right. So I always think of that Hunter Thompson, you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, where, you know, they're driving the Cadillac. He's like, we're outside of Barstow, but right around when the drugs began to kick in, you know, and they pick up the hitchhiker kid. And he's like, when are we going to tell him about the bats? And he's like, no point in mentioning it. The poor bastard's going to figure it out soon enough, you know? And you're sort of like, okay, when are we going to talk about the bats? Like, when are we going to talk, not in a Terrence McKenna, you know, EDM sample kind of fanciful way, but like, arguably, for all of human history, everyone from shamans to artists to Isaac Newton to Einstein to Buckminster Fuller, right? Every human who has brought through that Promethean impulse of like, I've been to the mountaintop, I've stolen or borrowed fire, and I'm bringing it back to seed civilization, technology, medicine, culture, art, religion, all of these things. Everybody's been doing those shuttle runs into the mystery. Sometimes they never talked about it. Oftentimes it was encased in mythologies, right, of what it all means or who's up there or whatever's going on. But like, can we get to a postmodern provisional description of that information layer that is so central in driving forward human development, growth, progress? And then can we sort of learn to stabilize the downlink? Mm. Right? What does it mean for us to take a step into kind of, and this is such a problematic term, but I'll use it as precisely and in a non-New Age way as possible. But what does quantum consciousness and culture look like? What does it mean for me to have a sense of identity, but self as process, not self as fixed and static entity? Can I understand, back to the seven generational thing, right? Can I understand my selfhood smeared across the timescape in a way that is distinct from I am an automated, you know, autonomous individual with agency and blah, 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 which is often illusory, right? And can we actually hold down what does it mean to be a spark of conscious evolution, self-aware, self-referential, and have access to all of that additional information, right? Not just in punctuated, erratic, ecstatic ways, but in embodied wisdom and increased foresight, increased compassion, and increased courage. Because, right, so much of our lives are based on seeking pleasure and avoiding pain, right? So as long as I'm doing that, I'm going to be a shitty person in the crux. I might be good on a good day, but when it really comes down to it, I'm going to break. Mm. I'm going to fold to cover my ass. So how do we unlock, and this goes back to Gandhi, this goes back to MLK, right? Gandhi called it Satyagraha, truth force, right? MLK called it soul force. He said, when we can meet the irrepressible, you know, pressures of physical force with soul force, then we have a chance to change the world. That was in his I Have a Dream speech, right? Yeah. And it was, and he borrowed it from Gandhi's notion. And so that sense of like, can we all know that our mortal lives, we're all our forfeit, we're all dead men walking. No one gets out of here alive, right? So, right, what do we do, as Mary, the poet Mary Oliver said, what do we do with this one precious life?
So interesting. I could go on for hours, but I'm gonna stop now. But thank you so much, Jamie. I told you before, but I really love your vision and how you see things. Also, because probably I agree very much with your point of view. That's probably why I love it. But I think it's super clear and super well. Yeah, you made a lot of thinking into it, and that's very amazing. So this podcast called Vlan, and in French it's onomatopoeia. It means slamming the door to something, or it could be slamming someone actually in cartoons. I would like to know what you would like to open or to close the door to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I just wrote an essay for our extended community at the Flow Genome Project. And it was basically saying, hey, we are at the end of the middle and the beginning of the end. So I would propose, and it was inspired by a conference I just attended that was filled with meta theorists and existential risk specialists, et cetera. And I was just floored by how disembodied and abstracted they all were. And how much they were still debating angels on pinheads, right? They were debating the finer points of their 17-page models and theories. They weren't playing well together. People were petty, and there were factions, and there were this and that. I was like, guys, the wave is coming. You're either on your surfboard paddling like a motherfucker, or you are going to be drowned in T-minus 10 minutes and counting. So my sense of what we might choose to shut the door on now are any disconnected, abstracted, or idealistic notions of how we're going to fix this, save this, do this, transcend this. And the door to open would just be super practical, here and now, human thriving at a local and bioregional level. If we're still talking about the Potsdam Climate Institute guys, that David Attenborough did a film I'd highly recommend. I think it's called Breaking Boundaries. It's on Netflix. It's only an hour long, and it's not about birds and trees. It's about Earth limits. And the Potsdam Climate Institute is arguably one of the leaders on level-headed, data-driven assessments of what's happening. And they basically came to the conclusion a year ago, year and a half ago, of, hey, folks, whatever's coming, which is clearly coming shortly, and in fact, it's not coming. It's here and around us. We're in the early stages. We are going over sort of Niagara Falls in the barrel we came in. So if anybody's offering a picture of, here's how we reinvent democracy, or here's how we rebuild capitalism into something new, none of that's going to happen. Here's how we save fractured politics. Nope. We are exactly who we are, going into this immediate future with the tools we have and with the deficits and faults we have. So closing the door on idealized, abstract, utopian escape hatches, including crypto, seasteading, digital nations, blah-bitty blah, and open the door to just WYSIWYG. You know, it's that old software developer's notion of, acronym WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. Like just getting radically reality-based. And, you know, my graduate study was all in history and anthropology because I was just geeked on it. I was like fascinated, like, how do we get to now? We're so weird, strange humans. This is bizarre. I'd like to learn more. But weirdly now, we're studying history to figure out what's coming. This is not a cocktail party dilettantism. We're actually, you need to understand how humans have done society. So do you guys have the board game Settlers of Catan? In Europe?
I don't think, the name doesn't recall anything. So maybe it's the translation, but...
It's a very popular game. It's a little like Risk and those others, but it's you know, you're on an island and you're dealing with neighbors and who has the timber and who has the minerals and who has the energy and who has the food.
I don't know this one.
And you play on these little octagonal games and chips. But fundamentally, we're entering sort of Settlers of Catan, Mad Max edition. You know, like, right? What do you have? How far away is it? Can you trade with your neighbors to get this, or are you going to have to go without? Like, and the more we can be just straightforward, back basically agents of history again, the earlier we do it, the more chance we have to do this with style and grace and creativity and joy and inclusivity. The longer we stay on the other side of that door, clinging to utopian escape narratives, the harder the hit will be.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Jimmy. That was great. So interesting. Oh,
Superman, I'm glad that lands for you.
Merci d'avoir écouté Vlan. Si vous avez aimé l'émission, n'hésitez pas à mettre des étoiles sur vos plateformes de podcast préférées. Vous pouvez aussi partager l'épisode sur vos réseaux sociaux, Instagram Stories, Facebook, LinkedIn, où vous voulez. Je suis Grégory Pouy. Vous pouvez me retrouver sur l'intégralité des plateformes sous le nom Greg from Paris. Si vous avez des idées pour des invités, si vous avez des commentaires, n'hésitez surtout pas à m'envoyer un message. Allez, merci et à bientôt.